Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is Michael Collins of Journey to Success Radio, and I'm here today and I'm waiting for our call to call in. I guess he's momentarily delayed with Ike Aikakou, and he's going to talk about his book, Winning the Money Game, which is going to be about finance, his personal journey, and what he does for people. So let me introduce myself. I am Michael Collins, and I'm the host of this show. I am the author of Ushering in the Golden Age, Elevate Your Consciousness, which is a book about creating a love-based, heart-centered psychology. And as we grow our consciousness, as we learn how to use love to resolve everything and take our power back, it is a much more freeing and much more generous way to live your life. My website is www.michaelmichaelrobin.com. And Ike has just joined us. Hello, Ike.
Good evening. How are you, Michael?
Okay, we're on the radio live right now.
Awesome.
So I just wanted to let you know that. I was just finishing up my introduction. Let me just finish that up, and then we'll get into the interview. So, again, you can reach me at www.michaelrobincollins, and my book is Ushering in the Golden Age, Elevate Your Consciousness. It's about looking at things from a new perspective and a new way to find more peace, love, and prosperity in your life. Good evening, Ike. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Michael. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. And just for our listeners, I was wondering if you could introduce yourself. I mentioned your book already, Winning at the Money Game, and just want to let the audience know a little bit about your background.
Sure. Well, I my background goes way back to Nigeria and West Africa. That's where I'm actually originally from. I ended up in the United States because my father and my mother both got their education in England and went back home, and my dad started his law practice. My mom worked as an accountant, retired from the government as an accountant. But throughout the entire time, they always wanted the kids to go off to Europe or to the United States for formal education. And even though my dad still has his law practice till today, he has always dibbled and dabbled in business. And back in the late 80s, he had an import-export business with business partners that were based in Columbus, Georgia. And so he just saw that as a great opportunity to kill two birds with one stone. And so we ended up here in the U.S. And I came here and finished up high school, college, and got into the workforce as an accountant, and worked in the Big Six industry for several years, specialized in tax, specialized further in personal financial planning, did that extensively, got licensed as a CPA, as a certified financial planner, got my master's in personal financial planning, and eventually went out on my own and started my own practice, and I haven't looked back since. So it's an abbreviated format, abbreviated version of sort of my past and what I've done.
Okay. And Ike, tell us a little bit about your book, Winning the Money Game.
Sure. The name of the book is called Winning the Money Game, Separating the Myths from the Truth, Everything You Don't Know About Achieving Financial Independence. And much like the title entails, it's a book that is supposed to empower readers with information that you're not going to find on air at CNBC or from any of the local financial gurus that you may subscribe to. Literally, I go as sort of I kind of go rogue on the industry and expose a lot of myths that financial advisors have disguised as financial advice that, in my mind, has caused quite a bit of the financial insanity that people have experienced over the past decade and even for longer periods than that. I was fortunate enough to be in a position to have achieved financial success at an early age, And I guess I'll say I was also fortunate enough to have lost all of my wealth and all of my fortune at an early age. But thankfully, God had another plan for me, and he allowed me to replace, replenish, and even exceed what I had before. And I went from a personal bankruptcy in 2003 to becoming financially independent in 2008. And in my book, I share a lot of the same strategies that I appropriated to do that. So really, I'm on a new mission to try to empower people to get retirement out of their mind and realize that the goal should be to attain financial independence. It's quite a bit different than just planning for retirement.
And how is that different? What are the differences that you see for those 2 points?
Sure. Well, if you think about retirement planning in the traditional sense, you know, what often comes to mind is the guy who's been a factory worker or worked for some organization for 30 or 35 years. And the way it's played out in most stories is they're at a job that provides for their family, but they completely detest what they're doing or feel like, you know, watching that clock and going through the countdown to where it's 1 day and 1 hour and 1 minute away from retirement is sort of where their lifeline is. That's all they kind of focus on. And in my mind, I think that's the wrong way to go about planning. And statistics actually back this up. There's information out there that proves that a lot of people who live those types of lifestyles typically die shortly thereafter retiring. So it's in essence, it's like they're putting their life on hold and waiting until they retire before they actually start living and embracing life and all it has to offer. And I think that's the wrong way to approach it. I think you want to properly orchestrate and plan your finances in such a manner that you grow your financial asset base to a point where those assets are able to generate the kind of income that you need to take care of your lifestyle. So in my book, I said if you needed $100,000 to live comfortably and you were able to accumulate $2 million in liquid assets that you could properly position in an investment that would generate a 5% return, well, that's a consistent, fixed, real 5% rate of return, then that's your 100 grand that you need to live off of. And that should be something that everybody shoots and strives for, because the goal of financial independence is to give you options. You want to have options to be able to live life to the fullest. So if you feel like you're called to be a missionary and you want to go off to Zimbabwe or some foreign country for 3 years out of your life, you need to properly plan to be able to do that. If you feel like you're called to do something else, if you've achieved financial independence, you can now live out your life's mission, your calling, whatever it is that you were put here to do. You can do that and do it to the fullest. And everybody I know who's really successful, who's tapped into this, you almost have to pull them away from whatever it is that they do. If you're a Christian and you're out there, you're listening, you know, everybody in the Bible that we know of, they don't speak about anybody retiring. Whatever they were called to do, they did that until they took their last breath. And I think once you tap into what your purpose is in life, you know, about health, you know, your health deteriorating is about the only thing I can think of that would ever stop you from ever wanting to continue doing whatever it is that you know you were placed here on earth to do. So that's my mission, is to try to empower people to live that kind of a lifestyle and to properly plan and strategize and financially position themselves to have that opportunity to do that.
Right. Well, the first thing that I want to talk to you about is because I believe in having a purposeful life. And so many times I think people go through life drifting and really not knowing what their purpose is. How do you help people find their purpose, or do you help people find their purpose?
I think it's one of the most empowering things you can do is to try to help people identify what their purpose is. And the way I relate to that is by helping people recognize that, you know, through the process of introspection, you can look at your life history. And in that, you're going to find some very consistent themes that are kind of woven into your life. And from those themes, you will be able to create and identify a story that completely defines who you are, why you're here, what empowers you, what ignites you, what gives you the stamina and the desire to want to jump out of bed every morning to go out there and make a difference in life. And so a lot of people end up in a job just because they need the job to pay certain bills or to make a living or to, you know, make provision, and you do need to do that. I'm not advocating against doing that, but what I try to help people recognize is we all have a very unique assignment. Michael, there is something that you were placed here on earth to do that if I tried to do it, I would fail woefully. It is as unique as your DNA is to you. And for every individual, there is that unique God-given assignment that they have that only them can fulfill because they are just designed to be able to do that and do it the way in which it's supposed to be done. And once you tap into that, that's when you tap into your life's passion. That's when you're the fullest, that's when you're the most alive because you are doing what you were created to do. And everybody needs to have the opportunity to experience that. And to do that, like I said, you got to take some time out and get into some introspection and really be able to kind of weave through the different themes in your life and kind of analyze what it is that gets you excited. Analyze what problems you see in the world today that you feel like, you know, just cause you to cringe in the inside and come up with the solutions that you think you want to apply to try to deal with those, you know, those circumstances in life that just, you know, cause you to go, ah, you know, I wish that were different or, you know, I feel passionate about this or I want to make a difference in life, you know, this issue or that issue. And for me, you know, financial independence and trying to empower people to live a full life, an abundant life, is one of my unique callings.
Well, it sounds like you incorporate a lot of spirituality into your financial practice. And
I do to a certain extent. It's a reflection of my makeup as an individual. I'm a Christian. I don't make any apologies for it. And so I interweave my faith where appropriate to try to empower people to see things from a different perspective. I don't necessarily go around preaching necessarily, but I interweave my faith and my relationship with Christ, and I use that to help serve the people I serve.
Right.
And I think it's important.
Right. And so many times people mix up spirituality with religion. And so when I say bringing spirituality, I think across all religions, all metaphysical schools, they're always talking about finding your purpose and that being the key. And just some of the other things that you said about people empowering themselves and finding that spirit within themselves and applying that to finance, I think is a very unique perspective to take and also a very empowering for your clients and for people who work with you and people who are looking for a way to include their spirituality in putting their finances together and seeing how that works hand in hand.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, you know, money is simply a tool. It's a resource that is given to us that is supposed to be used to exchange value. I don't care how wealthy you end up being, you're still only going to drive one car at a time. You're still only going to put one leg into a pair of pants at one time. You know, you can have 20 houses, but you can only live in one at one time.
Right.
So there isn't any measure amount of wealth that's going to be of any significance to me that will, you know, make that much of a difference and bring any certain level of joy or happiness. I recognize the importance of being financially independent because it serves a purpose. It serves a purpose in terms of me being able to do what I'm called here to do, to impact communities, to impact people's lives, to be able to stir and guide the wealth that, you know, God entrusts me with to make a difference, to create a legacy. And so whether it's writing a book and using that as a tool to try to empower people or doing other things that would come out of you trying to express your purpose and express, you know, what your unique assignment is, money helps facilitate getting that done as well as, you know, making a tangible difference in the lives of others. So when you look at money and wealth and resources from that perspective, I think you place yourself in a position to be a good a steward and somebody who can be entrusted with the requisite amount of wealth and financial resources, because the person who's entrusting that to you realizes that you're not just going to store it up and hoard it in your house. You're going to use it to make a difference either in the lives of the people that you serve or in the communities that you live in. But that's the thing is, you know, it's simply just a tool to be used to create a greater good in the lives of other people.
Right. So Ike, let's get back a little bit to your personal story.
Sure.
You said that you filed bankruptcy. You had been, you know, very successful and then kind of slipped away. And I know a lot of people have a lot of stigmas with bankruptcy, And what was that able to do? It was like almost being able to start over again for you, I would take it?
Yeah, it was a rude awakening. And, at a young age, I was fortunate enough to not only have been accomplished within my field of expertise, I was, passed the CPA exam the first time. I worked for Big Six accounting firms. I was doing all the right things, making money within my profession. But I've always been a student of money. And I talk about this in my book as early as 8 years old when I look back, which is something I try to help people do, is to look back through your life to identify significant events that you may or may not have paid attention to. But here's one that I paid attention to. At the age of 8, we had a tradition back home. I'm from Nigeria, and one of our traditions is around the Christmas time, we would go back to the village, the rural areas where my grandparents lived, and the entire family would convene for fellowship, spend the week there for Christmas and get to catch up with family, etc. But one of the traditions during that time was the younger kids would always do a little bit of show and tell and kind of tell the parents and aunts and uncles how well they did in school that year. And in return for good scholastic aptitude, we would be given rewards of gifts that were oftentimes money, monetary gifts. And while my siblings and brothers would and cousins would take their money and they'd buy toys or clothes or whatever their interest was at the time, I had created a makeshift bank out of one of my dad's old briefcases. So when I look back at that event, I look back at the fact that my mom was an accountant, and I look back at other events that have occurred throughout my life, it's no mystery that I'm doing what I'm doing. This is something that God planted in me at a young age that has stayed with me throughout the course of my life and has helped shape who I am today.
Right.
But to get back to the question of personal bankruptcy, so I acquired a measure of financial wealth initially in my career, and I invested in a lot of real estate. I bought and sold properties and had a pretty nice portfolio, made a lot of money flipping properties. And I had parlayed a lot of those profits into domestic and international and offshore investments. I remember making maybe $50,000 or $60,000 in salary early in my career, but because some of the investments I had were generating returns to the tune of about 10% per month, I was making about 3 or 4 times that much in just passive income.
Right.
And so I remember as a young adult attending churches and always hearing what I would call a prophetic word about my future and what I was here to do, and there was a consistent theme about me being a man of wealth. And I'd heard this so many times, and I was kind of reaping the fruit of this by seeing some of what was happening with the investments, that I remember getting so prideful and so almost disgusted when I heard it. It's like, okay, do you have something else to share about my plan and my life, my future, or do you hear God saying anything else about me? And basically what happened was I became so consumed by the gifts that I was entrusted with that I took my eye off of the person who was creating the opportunities to have that gift. So literally God put me through a Job-like experience where he stripped me of everything that I had and said, would you still worship me? Would you still honor me? Would you still maintain a relationship with me? And as I went through that dark, dark period in my life and I passed the test, he basically said that he would restore the fortunes that I had lost, and he would teach me how to keep those fortunes and how to help other people do what I would say, walk the narrow path, not conform to the pattern of this world, not do things the way everybody else is doing it. That's why I speak about this financial insanity that a lot of people have suffered, and why I'm trying to be that voice out there that's saying, look, there's a different way to go about addressing some of your financial goals. Yes, it's not popular. You don't hear a lot of people talking about it, but, there's a reason why the 1% is the 1%. There's a reason why the 10% is the 10%. They do things a lot differently than 90% of the rest of the population. And so I was, fortunate enough to reclaim all that wealth. And 5 years after my bankruptcy, I had replenished everything I had lost and then some. And like you said, there's a lot of shame, there's a lot of pride and just the stigma that's associated with a bankruptcy. But if you look at it in the light of why you were fortunate enough to go through something like that, it can only make you better and stronger and help you better focus in on what your purpose and your mission is. So, yeah, that's what it did for me.
Right. Well, I thank you for sharing that, because I think that's going to be helpful to a lot of people, because a lot of people now in this financial climate are thinking about bankruptcy, thinking about ways to start over, thinking about how to move beyond living from paycheck to paycheck.
Absolutely.
This is Michael Collins with Journey to Success Radio, and I'm talking with Ike. And Ike, pronounce your last name so I can get it right for the audience.
Sure, it's Ike Ikoku. Kind of rhymes with he owes you, Ikoku.
Ikoku. And Ike, why don't you give the people your website and your phone number so people can contact you? And I know that you have your best-selling book campaign coming up on June 12th.
Tuesday, June the 12th.
And just let people know a little bit about that. So if you can give them their information, your information right now, would be greatly appreciated.
Sure. Well, the name of the book, as we said, is Winning the Money Game, Separating the Myths from the Truths, Everything You Don't Know About Achieving Financial Independence. The book is available on June the 12th. All you have to do is go to my website. The website URL is www.winningthemoneygame.net, winningthemoneygame.net, not .com. And we encourage you to do so on Tuesday, June the 12th specifically, because that's our official book launch. And, you know, myself and a bunch of best-selling author friends and business associates of mine are so excited about my book and what it's going to do in this industry. It's literally going to create a financial revolution. And they are co-sponsoring this book launch for me. And as part of my goal to get my book in the hands of every family and every household in America, we are offering in excess of $127,000 in bonus gifts that will be available to people who purchase a book on Tuesday, June the 12th. They'll get to partake and share in a portion of that $127,000 in bonuses and gifts that will be available to everybody who purchases a book on Tuesday, June the 12th. So log into the website, www.winningthemoneygame.net, get a copy of my book, and get to share in some of the gifts that we're giving away.
Okay, thank you, Ike. And I know in your book you have about 9 different myths that you debunk about the financial game. Like, the number one myth is my home is my biggest investment. Do you want to talk a little bit about the myths in the book?
Absolutely. You know, a myth is nothing other than some rule of thumb that has been accepted to be the law, that's been accepted to be truth, that has been accepted to be a way of life. It's no different than people thinking that the earth was flat way back when, and you know, after Christopher Columbus sailed off of it and realized it wasn't flat, what was once accepted as a myth now is, you know, as a truth, was no longer being accepted. And so what I have done is literally looked at our industry and exposed a lot of the things that financial planners, financial advisors have promulgated and put within the minds of consumers as to be a truth that's to be accepted, and I've debunked those myths. And one of them is the whole idea that your house is your biggest investment. And if you read the chapters in my book that address this, you'll realize that not only is your house not an investment, it shouldn't be your biggest investment, and as a matter of fact, it's actually one of the lousiest and probably one of the riskiest investments you could have. And when I say house, I'm referring to your primary residence, not a piece of real estate that you've purchased as an investment property, but your primary residence. And in the book, I go and, you know, I list about, you know, 10 or 12 different reasons why that's not the case. And thank God for what's happened within the housing market today. You know, people who've gotten used to using their house as an ATM bank, you know, refinancing their mortgages every 6 to 12 months and pulling equity out, have now gotten to realize that housing values don't just go up, they go down as well.
Right.
And so that's been a rude awakening for people, but it's been a much needed awakening. You know, your house is the absolute worst place that you want to accumulate equity in. You know, I see people all the time that are interested in paying off their house because they think they're going to be safer with their house paid off.
Right.
And that's the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, think about the people who, right before Hurricane Katrina struck, they had gotten through the process of paying off their house and were excited about the fact of being debt-free. Katrina hits, housing values plummet. Worse yet, folks don't even have flood insurance.
Right.
And so a lot of those people were completely wiped out. All the money that they sunk in that house, whoosh, gone. Imagine how much of a stronger position they would have been in had they not paid off the house, but instead kept their money in an account that was liquid, that was accessible, that they had use and control of, such that if they were ever in a position where housing values plummeted, they lost their jobs, they got struck with a flood and didn't have any coverage, yeah, their house is damaged and they're out of, you know, a place to live, but at least they still have the $200,000 or $300,000 that they may have sunk into the house otherwise to pay it off. They have that now in an account that's accessible and that's safe, that's liquid.
Right. So do you advocate not purchasing a home but more or less renting?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you don't want to be wasting money by, you know, just renting. I mean, you have absolutely no opportunity to build value in a home. While I don't think your home is the best investment or your biggest investment, it certainly trumps renting because at least your home has the ability to appreciate in value. It's not a guarantee, but it does have the ability to appreciate in value. So when compared to renting, you'd much rather be in a position where you could build up some equity over the course of time by buying a house versus renting.
Right.
Another reason why I talk about why the home is not the biggest investment, nor should it be, and it's actually a pretty lousy investment, is I give the example of a guy who purchases a house for $100,000, sits on it for about 7 years, and, you know, does pretty good in appreciation, actually sells it for, you know, $200,000, and is thinking, wow, I just made 100% return. And in the examples in the book, I go over, well, how much they paid down on the house and how much they paid in interest costs during that time period, what they paid in repairs and maintenance and taxes, and I list out about 10 or 12 different expenses that significantly changed the return characteristics of the sale of that home. And what ends up looking like a 100% return after the course of time over 7 or 10 year stretch is really maybe only about a 30 or 20% return. And so when you do the math on that over a 10 year period, you know, you're making less than 2 or 3% in
right.
In return on that house. And, you know, if inflation is more like 4%, you're actually losing money over the course of time.
Right. And Ike, what would you say are some of the other myths that people commonly believe?
Another one has to do with the home. A lot of people who are looking to be debt-free think that getting a 15-year mortgage is a better way to be debt-free and pay off their mortgage than a 30-year mortgage. And what I try to enlighten people to the fact of is if here's what I hear all the time, Michael. A lot of people tell me, well, here's my 30-year plan. I'm going to take on a 15-year mortgage and pay it off, and then after the 15 year is done, I'll start saving for my financial future. And I go, not the most efficient way to go about doing that. There's a reason why compound interest is referred to as the eighth wonder of the world. The reason being is because the earlier you put that to work for you, the better off you'll be. So rather than waiting 15 years before you start saving, why don't we take the same amount of cash flow that we're talking about? If you can afford a 15-year mortgage, let's get a 30-year mortgage instead. The cash flow burden is going to be a lot less. What we'll do is we'll take the difference between what you'd have been paying on a 15 versus a 30. We'll take the tax savings difference between both of those two notes, and we'll put that into an account that is safe, that's liquid, that's accessible to you, that'll grow at a nominal rate such that even before the 15th year of that mortgage, that 30-year mortgage is up, we will have accumulated enough money in the side account to where if you thought it would be prudent to actually pay off that mortgage, you could actually do so before the 15th year while having kept a 30-year mortgage. All the while you've had your savings and investment account building and growing for you, taking advantage of the eighth wonder of the world and putting compound interest to its best use for you.
Right.
That's another myth. Another one that I love to talk about is the whole idea that, you know, a lot of people think that 401ks and IRAs are the best savings, retirement savings vehicles for them. Specifically, they think that they're actually saving money in taxes by putting money into those plans. And what I try to do is educate people to the fact that your traditional qualified retirement plans like 401ks and IRAs, all they do is they defer the tax and they defer the tax calculation. And so the play that people have on this is, and you hear this all the time, financial advisors will tell their clients, well, you know, you're going to be at a lower tax bracket at retirement. I'm like, really? So what kind of planning are you going to be doing to put yourself in a lower tax bracket at retirement? I tell clients that the absolute only way that you could end up in a lower tax bracket at retirement is if one of two things happens. The first one is that you end up being a financial failure, okay? And by being a financial failure, the way that would happen, I mean, if you think about the progression of most people's careers, they start out right out of college making a little bit of money. As they continue to do well in their job, gain more experience, they start making more money. And as their income increases, their lifestyle also increases. So at about the 35th year, when they're getting ready to retire, they've gotten accustomed to a certain level of income, a certain lifestyle. And so about the only way to be in a lower tax bracket at retirement is if you're living off of 50% of what you're accustomed to living, which would mean that you've done such a poor job of planning for your retirement that your assets are now only able to generate 50% of what you really need to maintain your lifestyle. And I don't know anybody who wants to go about planning for their financial future that way. I try to help all my clients to make sure that we at least replace their current income levels when they retire. That's, you know, that's where you want to be. So rule that out. You know, I don't think anybody wants to purposefully plan to be a financial failure. The only other way they'd end up in a lower tax bracket for contributions to a 401k or an IRA to work out to their benefit, to where they're actually paying less in taxes when they retire, is if the IRS just off the cuff decides, hey, you know what, we like the American taxpayers. I know we're at the one of the lowest marginal tax rate structures right now. Let's drop those rates even further in the future. Chances of that happening? Very unlikely.
Right.
When you know tax history like I know tax history, you know that we are at one of the lowest marginal tax rate structures that we've been in for a very long time. What a lot of people don't understand is our tax rates, our marginal tax rates have been as high as, check this out, 94%. You go back to about the World War I era, 1940s, we had tax rates that were as high as 94%. 94 cents of every dollar was being given to the government.
Wow.
When the IRAs and 401ks were first introduced into law, tax rates at that time were about 70%. So if you think about it, if the whole premise of a 401k or an IRA is let's defer the tax and the tax calculation into some future period, if you're already paying 70%, well, chances are you're probably not going to be paying a whole lot more in the future, right? Because, I mean, you're already getting close to 100%.
Right.
Versus today's day and age when you're already at 35% all the way down to 15 or 10% as the absolute lowest marginal tax rate. Well, if you're deferring it into the future, I mean, where do you think they're going to be in the future at this level? A whole lot higher, especially when you take into consideration that our tax history shows that taxes have traditionally gone up after we've gotten into wars and not paid for them. And there are at least three or four of them that I know we've gotten into over the past decade or so that we still haven't paid for.
Right.
We already know that we have huge, massive debt deficits to deal with in Congress. Social Security is basically financially bankrupt. We've got issues with Medicare and Medicaid, and we've got more people that are takers from the tax system than we actually have givers into the tax system. And we have a health care within our country that needs to be fixed and addressed. We've got huge, huge, huge issues that are going to continue to place a lot of burden and a lot of pressure on our tax system. So, again, you take all those things into consideration, and the only conclusion that I have is that tax rates are going to be much higher than they are at some point in the future now.
Right. In your studies, have you seen that right before an election, a presidential election, tax rates go down, and then right after the election, those rates go up?
Yeah, there are all kinds of shenanigans you see that happen during election years. I mean, you see crazy things happen during the stock market that make absolutely no sense. You see all kinds of tax policies that may be enacted, just as a strategy to gain the interest and the favor of taxpayers, and then things change. I mean, you know, it's all games. You know, our government is far from transparent with the American taxpayer. That much I can say.
Right. This is Michael Collins of Journey to Success Radio, and I'm on with Ike Akaku, and I'm going to open up the lines for any listeners who have any questions for Ike about their financial planning. The number to call in is 718-766-4453. That number again is 718-766-4453. And Ike, let me ask you this question. Let's say I'm a family man and I have about two or three children, and I want to start planning for them for college at a young age. What would you recommend for me to do, and what funds would you recommend for me to start with my children?
Well, that's an interesting discussion, because education planning is something that's near and dear to very many families. But what I try to get people to remember, and I hate using the word retirement because I'm trying to get people to focus more on financial independence, but for purposes of just keeping things simple, let's keep it at retirement. When we compare retirement planning to education planning, with education planning, we know that if our students do well in school, we orchestrate their high school years, make sure that they're involved in, you know, extracurricular activities. There are scholarships, there are grants, there are loans, there are resources that are made available to make it more palatable, easier to actually manage the education funding aspects of paying for your child's college. When we look at retirement or financial independence, there are absolutely no loans, there are no grants, there are no scholarships, there are no types of resources there to help aid and ensure that you become a financial success, that you hit retirement, you hit financial independence with the right level of resources to continue to provide for yourself for what some are saying now could be a much longer retirement period than we've traditionally been exposed to. So from that perspective, the first juncture would be to make sure that we don't sacrifice planning for your financial independence, planning for retirement, for the sake of planning for education, planning for the kids.
Right.
As long as that's not a sacrificial lamb that we're putting there on the altar, then we can look at cash flow, we can look at resources, we can try to identify how much we can save on a monthly basis, and then we can talk about the varying resources or the varying options that you have. Educational IRAs, 529 plans, do those make sense? Do you understand what they do? Do they meet with the risk-reward characteristics that you're looking for in a plan to fund education? We compare that to just about every financial product out there. We then educate our clients as to what they do, what they don't do, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Based off of that discussions, our clients are now educated and informed, and they're the ones who tell us, well, I'd rather put it here versus there, because they now understand the mechanics of what each financial product does versus what it doesn't do.
Okay. Ike, we have a caller, so I'm going to open up the lines to the caller.
Okay.
Hello?
Hi. Good evening.
Hi. Marbelle?
Yes.
Yes. What is your
Hello,
question?
Yes,
what is
absolutely.
Your question?
Hi, Ike. Good evening.
Good evening, Marbelle. How are you tonight?
Great, great, great. Thank you so much for actually touching on education planning, because my question was concerning that. A new mother, we're new parents to a 10-month-old, and logically...
Well, congratulations.
You know, thank you so much.
Such an exciting time for your family.
It is.
I have a little bit over 2-year-old child at home and almost 6-year-old, so I can certainly share in the same joys that you have.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
So my question was in regards to education planning. I mean, like, where, you know, starting out, we're figuring things out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not necessarily as educated as we should be about 529. I find very interesting your point stating that I think it's true. We stress more education planning than we have retirement planning.
Sure.
And now my eyes are open because I see your perspective and how that makes sense. But then how much education planning should we do? It should be nothing at all. And if so, what are like the most rewarding plans out there at this time?
Well, my first response will be get a copy of my book because it'll answer a lot of the questions that you have.
Of course.
But beyond that, one of the things that I do is I say everybody needs to have a parking garage for their money. Okay.
Okay.
And by parking garage, it's somewhere where you accumulate money for the long term that's accessible, that's safe. I mean, chances are you guys may live in a house or an apartment or somewhere where you can park your car. You guys have a garage where you live?
No, we live in the city, unfortunately. We're working.
Oh, you're in the city. Okay.
Moving out of the city.
There you go. Well, a lot of people who live in suburbia typically have like a garage in their homes. And when I ask them the question, well, why don't you just leave your car out in the streets? They typically go, well, it's not safe out in the streets. You know, you got the elements to worry about. Somebody could break into the car. Somebody could abuse it. I stick it in the garage because I know it's safe. I go, very good. And I go, well, when you decide that you want to take a vacation, you want to go to some exotic location, you want to see the country, what do you do with the car? You pull it out the garage, you go to that place, you enjoy the benefits of being there, and then you bring it back. This parking garage concept is very important because it's the basis for understanding where you should be accumulating your money. You want your money essentially somewhere where you know it's safe, it's accessible to you. If you ever needed it to do something in terms of growing, you can pull it out of that garage, stick it, and take it for that journey to reap the benefits of whatever it is that you want to do with that particular investment. And then once you've reaped those benefits, you pull it back, you stick it to where it's safe in the parking garage, and you look for the next opportunity. The problem with most people who plan for the financial future is whether it's 529 plans, which are very restrictive in terms of once you put money in there, what can you actually use the funds for? It has to be for education and nothing else. A lot of those traditional type education funding plans are very much like that. You don't have a lot of liquidity. You don't have a lot of access to it. Once the funds are in there, they are locked up. And so sticking with that parking garage concept, as we look at all the different financial products that are available to us, what we want to do is try to identify the one that serves as a parking garage, that gives us the liquidity, use, access, and control to our funds to where we can go in and out of that garage as we need to, continue to plan for our financial future and do some of the things that we want to do. And when that need comes up, whether it's retirement, whether it's education funding, whether it's paying for the child's wedding, we're not restricted because it says it's a 529 plan or it's an educational IRA. It can only be used for this or that. And so in my book, it's chapter 7 or 8, I think it is, it talks about what makes the most sense to be your parking garage. And I get into very specific discussions as to why a properly designed and a properly structured life insurance contract, a permanent cash value type life insurance policy, could be a great place to park your garage. Because it's safe, it's liquid, it's accessible. It allows you to pull money out of that garage and go do exotic things like make more money with other investment opportunities that are available. And I go through a list of about 12 different benefits that you get from a properly designed and structured insurance contract that does all these different things that really most other investment products don't do. That's not to say that that's where all the money is going to reside, but again, it should be the parking garage. And as we identify different opportunities that can make more money for us, we take money out of that garage, we stick it in that investment. As we get the return that we're seeking, we pull it back into the insurance policy, and it's safe, it's protected, it's accessible to us. So that's why I say it's going to be really good for you and beneficial to understand more of the meat of what I just talked about and how it compares to some of the traditional things that we've accepted as vehicles of choices to use to save for this and that and whatever else we think we want to save for our, you know, our future financial needs.
Wonderful. Thank you for the insight. One other question just to follow up, because
sure.
I feel like as new parents you think about education planning, and also since we live in the city, obviously, you know, in a couple of years or so we're going to want to move into like our first home.
Okay.
Are there any myths? I know you mentioned earlier about people investing at home in their primary residence and that not being the ideal situation. So then what is your recommendation?
My recommendation is to put as little money as you can into a home. And here's why.
Okay.
I ask people a lot of time, how much, what's the rate of return that you're getting on the equity in your house? And I laugh when I listen to the responses because, you know, I get very educated responses. Oh, you know, I've had the house for 6 or 7 years and this and that. And that. I think I'm getting 6%, 4%, you know, just varying numbers. And I go, well, in reality, you're not really getting anything. There's no return on the equity in your home. Here's a perfect example. Two guys buy a house for $100,000, same neighborhood, same floor plan, same the whole nine. One guy pays $100,000 for the house in cash. The other guy only puts 10% down. Let's say 20% because that's typically what they're trying to require. So he puts 20% down on the house. Same house appreciates in value to $100,000. Seventh year, they're like, okay, we're done with the neighborhood. We're ready to move. They both sell the house for $200,000. The first guy makes 100% return on his money, right? 100 went to 200,000. The second guy makes $100,000 profit as well. But guess what? How much money did he have to put up?
Right,
to buy the house, 20%.
Right.
The other guy put 100% down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So did the amount of money each one put into the property have anything to do with how much it appreciated?
Right, understood.
Absolutely not, right? The guy who only put 20% actually made more money on his investment because 20% or $20,000 converted to a $100,000 gain, which is a 500% return. Now, what if he could have put zero down? That'd have been the best case scenario, right? Because it would have still appreciated to $200,000. He still would have made 100% profit with absolutely no investment in the property. What if that same property went backwards and actually was only worth $50,000? Who do you think is sitting a lot prettier, the guy who paid $100,000 in cash for it or the guy who financed it 100%?
The first guy.
The guy who financed it 100%, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, because he's got nothing invested in the house. So the question
then,
is, would you...
Yes, I'm sorry.
Sorry, the question is, would you take money that you have right now, stick it in a tin can, and bury it in the back of your house?
Would I do that?
Yeah, would you do that?
No.
Yeah, it seems ludicrous, right? I mean, the dogs
yes.
come eat the can, steal it, and it's all gone. Worse yet, it's doing nothing for you, right?
Right.
Same problem with trying to stick any amount of equity in your home. It does absolutely nothing for you. It's like that money sitting in a tin can buried in the backyard. God help you if you can actually remember where it is. But it's
so then
doing absolutely
follow-up.
Nothing for you.
Short follow-up. So then how do you get to a point where you have it 0% down? Like, do you save up to that point, or are there resources that allows
yeah,
you
I mean, there's even in today's market, there are still creative financing options available there where you may get an 80% first mortgage, 10, 15, 18, 17, 20% second mortgage, and end up with a situation where you have the house 100% financed. I mean, you know, you got to be a little creative and work with the right kind of people who can structure those.
Okay.
But ideally, if you still end up having to put 5, 10, 15, 20%, then the goal is, you know, short-term savings, let's try to accumulate that amount of money, keep it somewhere that's liquid, that's accessible, and then once we've hit that point, then we now have what we need for our down payment to put down towards the purchase.
Great. Thank you so much, Ike. Extremely insightful, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling in.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you, Ike. And you know, we're coming down to the last 10 minutes of the show. This hour has gone by very quickly.
It's blown by, hasn't it?
It has. Any financial advice you want to give people? Because, you know, just listening to this, I know myself personally, I've never thought about investing this way. And what you're saying makes so much sense. And from scanning through the book, it makes so much sense. My first question to you would be, you're based in Atlanta, correct?
I am based in Atlanta, yes.
Do you do phone consultations and do you work with people?
Oh, yeah, I am not restricted by geography at all. As a matter of fact, I may have more clients out of state than I do in state. So, I mean, we serve clients throughout the country. One of the things that I have found is, especially in this day and age, you want to work with the right individual. And to identify who the right individual is, you shouldn't restrict yourself to somebody who's 5 minutes from your home or 10 minutes from your home. You know, I know of people who deal with advisors that are in the opposite extreme. They live in the East Coast, but the guy's in the West Coast. Why? Because he has something different to say. He's working with that 10%. He understands that to help achieve and accomplish what you truly want to do in life, you can't do what everybody else is doing. That's the definition of insanity. If what you've been doing isn't working for you, chances are it's time to do something different. It's kind of like the quote I have in the book from Stephen Covey, and he says that a lot of people have their ladders leaning up against the wrong wall. And as they race up that ladder, all they're doing is getting to the wrong place faster. And so we want to make sure our ladders are leaning up against the right wall. And from that, I take you need to identify who the right and the best fit is for you as a professional. And if they live in a different state, you know, in a different city, technology today makes it so easy to be able to work with people that may not be, you know, right in your backyard. So. Yeah, so we certainly deal with clients that live in different states than we do.
Okay. And on that note, Ike, why don't you give the listeners one more time your information about how they can contact you, give them the website, and give them information about your book launch on June 12th.
Absolutely.
And how they can get a copy of your book, Winning the Money Game.
Sure. The Accounting, Tax, and Financial Advisory website is basically my name. It's www.ikeikoku.com. That's www.ikeikoku.com. The site that hosts our book, speaking engagements, that has copies of my local radio shows, on-air interviews, the brand itself is winningthemoneygame.net. So you want to go to www.winningthemoneygame.net. And it's there is where we have this awesome book promotion. We talked about this earlier. We're so excited about the opportunity to get my book into the hands of consumers. I mean, I believe and I wholeheartedly believe this. Not having a copy of our book is the equivalent of financial suicide. I am that passionate about what it is we have to say and share in this book. And so I am doing my best to try to make sure we get it into the hands of every family, every household that's represented in the good old United States of America. And to do that, I have partnered with several of my best-selling author friends and business associates that I have the privilege to know. And they, in addition to myself, we are offering bonuses in excess of $127,000 to anybody who logs onto our website on Tuesday, June the 12th. The website address is www.winningthemoneygame.net. Log on Tuesday next week and purchase my book, and you get an opportunity to partake in well over $127,000 in bonuses that we are offering. It's all detailed on the website. You can see exactly what's going to be available to you. Phone number is 1-888-WTMG-IKE. That's 1-888-986-4453. It spells WTMG Ike, Winning the Money Game with Ike. That's a 1-888 phone number. So you can reach us by telephone. You can reach us on the web. Either one of those are probably the best methods to get a hold of us.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that information. And I encourage the listeners to call in, talk to Ike, and really get your finances on track, because his ideas are very innovative. And I have to say, I met Ike down in Philadelphia at Steve Harrison's publicity summit. And when I heard him spoke down there, I was very impressed and wanted to learn more instantly about what he was doing and what his ideas were on financing. And now when scanning through the book and interviewing Ike right now, I would recommend Ike highly, I would recommend the book highly, and I would recommend that you participate in his book launch and really start to take your power back. Because in the beginning of the conversation, we talked about it's important to empower yourself. And having that financial freedom is one of the greatest ways to empower yourself and open up yourself to worlds that you don't know exist out there yet. And most importantly, to find and understand and have ways to finance your purpose and live the lifestyle so that you can bring your uniqueness to the world. We're down to our last 5 minutes, so Ike, any other tips, anything that you would like to say to people about their finances that you find that are very important or very in the moment and very relevant in this moment that you'd like to share with people?
Yeah, one interesting question that we've gotten on our radio show of recent, just because it's been in the news, is a lot of people have asked, well, you know, should I have invested in Facebook? There's an opportunity to buy Facebook. Should I have gotten that? And, you know, my take is there's a bit of a difference between gambling versus investing. And when you put the entire focus on just one stock, to me that's gambling, because there is decades upon decades. I mean, the gentleman who came up with modern portfolio theory basically set the stage for what you need to do to build a properly diversified portfolio of stocks. And so if you're going to invest, then you want to invest. You want to invest in 20 to 21 different asset classes. You want to own a piece of different sectors and different asset classes and companies within those asset classes. And collectively, the asset classes themselves are what's responsible for getting your market return. Not owning a Facebook, not owning a Google, especially for what I would say probably is 90% of the population, where people may not necessarily have the extra cash to gamble and speculate. Now, if you want to speculate, that's perfectly fine. It's no different than going to Vegas and you know, playing the slot machine or gambling. That's what you're doing when you concentrate your efforts in just one stock with the hopes of it making a significant difference for you in your portfolio. And so we got that question a lot, and even as I did a little bit of research and looked at Facebook, when it went public at $38, what the underlying value was it was saying that each Facebook user was worth about $100 in revenue to the company. And as of their financial statements for the year ended in 2011, they reported that each Facebook user was only worth $4 per share to the company. And even for the first quarter of 2012, that number was headed down. And so people buying in at $38, thinking these are the good old days of the tech, you know, bubble of 98, 99, where you could buy a stock like Amazon or whatever, kind of blink your eye, and the next day you look at it and it's up $10. We're living in completely different times. It's kind of like that Cadillac commercial. This is not your grandfather's Cadillac.
Right.
The day and age we're living in, this is not the 1990s anymore. Things have changed, and they've changed for the better. And so, people just need to take a little bit more personal responsibility for their financial lives. And seek to educate themselves. You know, there's a plethora of information that talks about the consequences of not knowing. And that doesn't say you have to completely change your vocation and go learn about finances. But you want to have a well-rounded knowledge about what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And oftentimes that's also helped by working with somebody who prides themselves on educating their clients about the why behind their decisions, not just what they're doing, but the why. You got to know big picture, sort of where you're going and why you're invested in what you're doing. I mean, I have conversations with folks all the time. They go, well, we own this, or we bought this, or we have this investment. And I go, why? Why do you have that? And they don't have a logical response that they can give me. And so, I mean, you need to understand what you're doing for your personal financial lives and why you're doing what you're doing. And it's got to be for your intended purposes, and not the purposes of some other slick individual that may just be interested in gaining some financial gain by making some recommendation to you. And so that's where the personal responsibility piece comes into place, with people taking a little bit more ownership about their financial lives.
Okay. Well, Ike, I want to thank you for sharing this information. And again, for the audience, I'm talking with Ike Ikeoku, and the name of his book is Winning the Money Game. And as Ike has announced, he is doing his book launch on June 12th. I suggest highly, very strongly that you participate in the book launch and sharing the information that Ike has shared with us. Again, thank you, Ike, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks for having me on the show, Michael. It's been a pleasure. Love to do it again sometime with you.
Okay, we will.
All right. Thanks to the college for listening. Hope you guys have a wonderful day.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Hello. You've been listening to Journey to Success Radio. This is Michael Collins, and thank you for listening. Bye.